Welcome to Season 9 of American Political History, Wars Within Wars, the Good Friday Massacre. At the beginning of 1715, South Carolina appeared to be the strongest military power in the South, but its strength had been in its alliances with Native nations. During the Tuscarora War, most of the people fighting in South Carolina's expeditions had been Yamasee and Creek warriors. Even runaway slaves, indentured servants, and debtors were mostly caught and returned by Native warriors. In the spring of 1715, South Carolina was doing well economically. Its plantations were extending in all directions, and the Indian trade appeared to be thriving. But this prosperity had led to military complacency. The colony had expanded well past its own defensive fortifications, and those fortifications had been minimally supplied. The Good Friday Massacre was not limited to Pocatalico. The Indian trade was seasonal. In the spring, all of Carolina merchants were out conducting trade with natives. The southern native population had coordinated their attack in unison. That morning, almost every Carolina merchant was killed at the hands of Carolina's allies. The only survivor of the Good Friday Massacre at Pocatalico was Captain Burroughs, who was shot twice, once in the back of the neck, which shot out of his mouth, and the second would be permanently lodged in his chest. He managed to escape by running wounded 5 miles to the nearest Carolina settlement and sounding the alarm. Although the native nations had coordinated the sudden attack upon the merchants, each native nation would raid Carolina independently. Because of proximity, the Yamasee would be the first of the native nations to attack Carolina territory, destroying all nearby plantations. The unlucky male captives would be stripped naked, hands tied and tethered to a large stake. They would be unable to escape, where they would be beaten by small clubs by the Yamasee warriors and their wives. The fate of women and children, if they were captured, was enslavement. There are no detailed records of this opening attack, but hundreds, if not close to 1,000, were killed at the hands of natives in the opening days of the war. In Charleston, a cannon fired, signaling for the assembly of the militia, 240 strong, and they would set out to attack Pocatalico. A few days out, they were ambushed by the Yamasee, who had organized themselves into a half-crescent, allowing the militia to fall into the trap where they could flank them on both sides. For the better part of an hour, they battled. Governor Craven would rally the militia into a firing line, which would then charge with fixed bayonets. The Yamasee would retreat at the sight of this, not wanting to get entangled into hand-to-hand combat. After discovering from a wounded Yamasee warrior how widespread the native attack was, Governor Craven ordered the militia back to Charleston. Meanwhile, McKay and Barnwell organized their own personal militia of 200 soldiers and attacked Pocatalico. Since the village's warriors were off attacking the Carolina colony, they easily sacked the village and then retreated back to Port Royal, where they would begin construction of their own fort. Their quick attack on the Yamasee had made the women and children of the native nation move west, hoping that the distance would protect them from other such attacks. The South Carolina Assembly convened a special session where Governor Craven addressed the colony, saying, "If we do not at this juncture strenuously exert ourselves and animate one another with a superior courage to our enemies, if we do not make speedy and necessary preparations for ammunition and provisions for our men and take care of our women and children, we shall soon be useless and a burden to each other." Carolinians knew they were outnumbered in this war nearly 5-1. The only thing the colony had going for it was that they were fighting against separate native nations, who had no unified leadership or coordination on the battlefield. Governor Craven looked for allies. The Creek and Yamasee had killed Carolina merchants. They were out. The Cherokee had not picked a side. They were likely waiting to see who was more likely to win the war before deciding who to pick as their ally. In the days after the Good Friday Massacre, only 7 merchants had returned to Charleston. They were now dispatched to travel to the Cherokee to see if there was any room for negotiations. Governor Craven also sent word to the other colonies. To North Carolina, he would ask them to return the favor for their aid in the Tuscarora War. Virginia's Governor Spotswood agreed to send 300 militia to aid South Carolina, but they would have to pay a bond for each militiaman Virginia sent. South Carolina would be required to send 1 African slave, who would be returned to the colony upon the return of Virginia's militiamen. New England was willing to sell South Carolina arms and ammunition in exchange for deerskins. When an English frigate happened to anchor at Charlestown, The ship's captain was unwilling to sell the colony gunpowder, but the ship's captain was willing to take several tons of rice in exchange to transport war supplies from Boston to Charlestown. Within the colony, Governor Craven issued martial law. His goal was to maximize their defensive strength around Charleston. He ordered all colonists back to Charleston or Port Royal. Surviving livestock was collected and moved back to plantations nearby. An inventory was taken of all firearms and ammunition. The militias numbered were bolstered with African slaves. Laws were passed for more severe punishment for desertion. The plantations of the Bakweglas, Watts, Snow, Haskell, and Mowell families were converted to fortified refugee camps for women and children. The conditions quickly became crowded and unsanitary, rife with disease. There were three elements to the military defense: build and defend garrisons at key locations near Charlestown, develop a mobile force that would conduct offensive operations, and create a waterborne force to operate in the waterways to the southwest. A dozen plantations were quickly converted into European-style fortifications, equipped with moats, trenches, stockades, palisade walls, and when possible, bastion towers. Surrounding the fortifications, they would clear 200 feet of vegetation so that no one could sneak up. To the north along the Cooper River, it was the plantations of Richburg and Wantoot families. To the west of Charleston along the Ashley, Cypress, and Stono Rivers, it was the plantations of the Cattell, Elliott's, Beemore, Percival's, and LaRoche's. To the south, along the road between Charleston and Port Royal's, the Nichols family plantation was turned into a fortification. And on Bennett's Island, the Bennett family plantation was turned into a base camp for scouting patrol boats, who would protect the inland passages between Port Royal and Charleston. In the summer, the Colonial Assembly further strengthened Governor Craven's issuing of martial law. Now the government would embargo all ships, muster the entire militia, and seize all privately owned arms and equipment for use by the militia. They also approved war bonds and raised property taxes to collect further funding for the war. All of this legislation was written and passed in just 8 days. Thank you for listening to this episode of American Political History. If you want to support the show, please subscribe and leave a 5-star rating. And share the show with someone you think would enjoy listening. Thank you again, and until next time.